You're listening to Art and Magic, and I'm your host, Devin Walls. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the show. This is kind of a special bonus episode in that it is the part two continuation of last week's conversation with Andrea Gazzetta. Because Andrea is so entertaining and has so much to share and is so great at talking, I got the pleasure of talking with her for 2 hours, and that kind of created a little bonus episode for us here on the show. So if you haven't listened to that one yet, I kind of recommend going back and listening, but also I think you can enjoy this part first and then go back and listen to the first part. It's up to you. Choose your own adventure. I actually got a lot of great feedback on the first part of this conversation, and the main thing was that it was so relatable. And that makes me really happy to hear because, like I said, my intention for this season, or at least these upcoming episodes, is just to give you an insight into what I actually talk about with my artist friends. So I'm kind of feeling like mission accomplished with that. So anyway, I really appreciate the shares and the kind messages. It really helps us get the show out there and also kind of like reminds me of why I do this. So thank you. So as a little refresh, Andrea and I set out to have a conversation about mental health as working artists, but we ended up talking about a whole lot of other stuff too. And in fact, I think we talked about mostly other stuff, but we also talk about mental health. So in this episode, we talk about getting out of isolation, financially setting yourself up for your own ups and downs, how trauma and mental health issues have influenced our work, making art books. And I actually think my favorite part of the conversation was when we talked about art openings and how to associate yourself with your work and get people to remember you, and also how to talk to new people. I think a lot of us know that we should be going to openings to make connections, make friends, talk to our peers, potentially network a little bit. But the idea of actually talking to people that you don't know is kind of terrifying. At least I know that it is for me. And Andrea is like the perfect person to talk to about this because not only have I witnessed in real life how her ability to meet new people has really benefited her career, but she's like really good at it. And so just getting to hear her talk about that, I think was very beneficial for all of us introverts, myself very much included. Okay, so before we get into it, just a couple announcements and reminders. One of the best ways that you can support the show is over on Patreon. There's actually a library of exclusive bonus episodes over there waiting for you. So if you've blown through everything that's published, you can go listen to the secret episodes over there. You'll also get early access to all of my drops and new works and stuff like that. If you're somebody who follows my work and you're interested in it, the other thing I have going on right now is a big studio cleanout sale. It was a big project to get all the photos together, get the pricing together, and set it all up, which is why I've been putting it off. But I'm very much ready to clear out my old work. You know, if you've been following me for a while, I used to work in quite a different style. And while I still think that those pieces make for beautiful additions in people's homes, it's just not where my work is headed anymore, and I'm really ready to make space for my new stuff and also fund the new work. The new work always needs funding. It's kind of how it goes when you're a working artist. So anyway, I have like killer discounts going on flawed prints, studies, small works, and then there's kind of like a silent auction for bigger pieces, and all of that is going to run through August 1st. So I recommend checking that out. I will put the link in the show notes. And yeah, if you just want to see what my old work used to look like, that's a good place to go see. Okay, I think that just about covers it. So without further ado, let's get back into this awesome conversation with Andrea Gazzetta. Okay, I do have like a couple things I would like for us to touch on in the mental health realm.
I love
it. For one, just because like we've talked so much about like, you know, what we bump up against, I would like for us to talk a little bit about how we cope. Like, what have you found to be the most helpful for you in order to either manage your mental health or manage your business while grappling with your mental health?
Okay, here's the thing. The answer shouldn't be sex, but it is sex. It's having sex with the partner that you love, that you actually care about regularly, is pretty solid for helping with a lot of like depression, anxiety. It resets your system. It makes you, you know, my partner is pretty chill person. I feel super safe. Like having another warm body in the room with me keeps me from a lot of my spiraling. And he's also just a very calm person. So like, I've dated other people that also have anxiety, depression, etc. And when you have two people that do that, what can sometimes happen is I'm anxious. And then it's like becomes almost a comp, like you're both stressed out and you just stress each other out. But if you have someone that is, I call him like the ocean and I'm like on fire, it's like sometimes he's like, oh, just come here, come get this hug. We don't have to focus on that right now. That helps. So just like being in relationship to having like good friends, like people like you, people like my friend Abby, people that I can talk to openly about what I'm going through and recognize like, oh, I'm not alone. Like I had a tough day and Devin came to my house and did all my dishes. She's a really good friend. Because I was like just getting out of my depression hole, and she's like, hey, what if we tidied your depression hole so it was less sad, so you could actually do stuff? I'm like, you have no idea how helpful that is. But she does know, because people have shown up for her in that way. And so like stuff like that, like having friendship, being in relationship with people, sex is great. But I think it has to be meaningful sex, not like hookups. I'm not a hookup
not
person.
Tinder sex.
Tinder, ugh, that's just you trying to fill your hole with yeah. another with trash.
Yeah,
zero stars. But yeah, things like that help. Also, like I have a morning routine that's like I make breakfast, I go for a walk, I take my dog outside. So some days I really don't even start work till like 10 9:30, but the fact that I have exercised, the fact that I've made myself get out of bed, I made myself get dressed, like I ate some food, all those things sort of help your brain renormalize and get out of the pit. I call it the pit, where you're stuck. It's like quicksand and you can't get out. And you're like, I need someone to pull me out. Sometimes you need a friend to help you out of the pit. Sometimes you need medicine to help you out of the pit. It's never alcohol. You think it is, but it never is. So that's not helping you out. But like there are things you need to do for yourself to like get yourself out. And there is this really bizarre idea. And I think it's an idea that makes me angry. That's like, well, I can't help you get out of your pit. It's not my responsibility for your mental health. And I think that there is I think in the West, because we do not have community, like, so in a lot of Eastern cultures, like India, Japan, stuff like that. I'm not going to speak to Japan. I haven't been there, but I've been to India. In a lot of Eastern cultures, family is something very different than it is in the West. And people generally have some type of community, and the community comes together to help individuals who are struggling. And I think that is one of the causes of a lot of depression that we have in our culture, is that like people see other people struggling as not their responsibility. People see homelessness as not their responsibility. And I think that there's this idea that like, if someone else is struggling, it's not your responsibility to help them. But fundamentally, we need community and we need relationships. So like friendships, relationships, community, all those things are connected. And I think like the biggest struggle of our era is finding a work-life balance so that we can have a community that is not centered around our jobs.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, you know, the people, when you were saying like, you know, Devin gets it because she's been through it. I think that is the case, is actually the people who end up making the strongest community around you are the people who get it, because they know how crucial it is. And that's something that I really would like to cultivate more of. And I think is the reason that I am also here today, like literally. Yeah. And so
why rich people are lonely.
That is extremely important. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I would say too, like when you were saying, you know, you have a routine and all of that, like for depression, especially like, and especially if you're an artist who works from home, like I know you are. And I've actually been working more from home just because I've been on the more tired side. Like having to leave the house at a certain time is really important. And people with like certain kind of jobs already have that built in.
Yes.
So you really, and the thing is for me, like the voice of a lot of my issues is like, not today, just a little longer, like a slow morning is fine. And it is fine. But I really know that sometimes just like going out and being a participant is really important for my mental health. And the other thing too, and I know you're going to be able to relate to this given the experience you just had, is, and we've talked a lot about how finances and poverty and all that are like directly correlated to mental health. So for me, it's making, because I know that I go through stints where I have no energy and I like have episodes of depression and all this, like I have to set myself up so that I can still have some income coming in, like even if I'm not actively painting or working. And for me, that's been prints, which has been super awesome. And, you know, I'm only just now getting to experience that for the first time. I've never had that before, but I'm realizing how important that is, especially if you're someone who goes up and down. It's like crucial.
Yeah. If you have an artistic practice that you can print, good for you. You now have what is essentially a source of income that you don't really have to do a ton of extra work for. Prints is why I'm willing to sell original paintings sometimes for a little bit less than what their value is in terms of time, because I know I can make some money off of prints. Prints are an affordable option for a lot of people. I did like a run of sketchbooks. I did a run of books. Stuff like that are things that like, it takes time to put a book together. It takes time to source a sketchbook, but those are things that you can kind of do that are lower impact also on your body than painting. Like you're not physically painting the whole time, which like is really hard on your body. I think people
and it's super real and people don't talk about that a lot. Like, no, it's a physical thing. Like, sorry, just had to interject that because I think that's a lot.
I like when you and I, because we went to a gallery and they had this book there and Devin randomly opened it to a page that talked about when your hand hurts. And I was like, fuck. So I've been wearing like a brace, like, and I made a meme reel about it on my Instagram page. You can check it out. But I've been wearing like a brace to paint, and it's something we don't talk about enough, is like, it's like a sports injury. It's like tennis elbow or something like that. And people kind of assume that you can just paint all day forever, and you can't. Like, you have to go, your eyes can get tired, your hand, your body, your neck, all those things get tired. I tried to invent an easel that had like an armrest, and then I remembered that's what that dumb stick is that people use, but I hate that. I don't want to use the weird stick with the soft stuff on it. I really just want it to be able to be like connected to my easel. But then I was like, it would need like a 3-point locking system. And I was like, oh, that's why they just use the stick. Actually, that makes sense. Never mind. Because you'd have to change the position all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, for real. Okay. So also something I kind of want to talk about is like, the way that our journeys with mental health have influenced our work over time. And like, if you notice a change in your work, either in the short term or the long term, and I'm grappling with some questions myself about what happens when your work is a lot about your trauma and a lot of your powerful messages come from a place of grief, and then you start to feel better. That's something I'm thinking about, but I want to hear from you first.
Actually, Daniel Toledo and I, another great, his Instagram handle is at Mr_Toledo. He's great. Check him out. We actually had an interesting conversation about that because he's struggling with something similar. And for me, when I was younger, like when I was in high, so a lot of my trauma, like the really intense trauma, happened in my childhood. Did it forever scar my central nervous system? For sure. for me, a lot of my specific trauma that, you know, scarred my central nervous system, made me dysregulated, et cetera, happened when I was really young. So for the most part, I've kind of gotten over that. You know, I haven't had any like really traumatic, besides like, you know, breakups with boyfriends cheating on me. That's traumatic. That sucks. But it's not something I'm making art about necessarily. But like a lot of the stuff with my parents, I think the last time I was physically present and had like a traumatic incident with my parents, I was like 27. I'm 35 now. So that's kind of old news. I'm not really making art about that. What I'm making art about actually is what kind of happened is I was sad. I was a sad girl. I made sad art. It was brown. It had skulls in it all the time. It was kind of a fucking bummer. Then when I was like, I don't know, 27, whatever, I was like, man, this shit is a bummer. I wouldn't buy this. Like, I don't want this in my house. Why? I like pink. I like bright colors. I like fun things. What if I started making art that was fun and pretty and that I liked? So I would say that my art is a direct response to trauma in the way that it's like, I am choosing something that makes me happy. So I'm going to make a whole world that's filled with rainbows and animals, and I think it's cute, and suck my dick if you don't like it. Like, that is bringing me joy. That is fun for me. Do I also touch on like death and mortality? For sure. But the way I view death is that it's a part of life. So it doesn't bum me out like that. I think it's kind of beautiful. So for me, my work is not about my trauma. My work is in direct opposition to my trauma. And so for me, my work is every day helping me fight my trauma. I know that's different for you though. So I'm gonna let you talk about what your thoughts on that are.
Well, some of my work is actually basically what you just said, like leaning into the things I like, creating a safe space because of my experiences, because that's soothing to me. So that's like half of it where it's like 100% on par. But I also do find catharsis, I think, in like bringing in some of the darkness and like also acknowledging the tension and just the nuance of this person inside of me that is like so innocent and loves pink and is just like wants to go back to like a princessy world forever. And like also what was dark about that time and the reasons that I can't. And just like the conflict there. But I will say like my work has gone through phases where it is like lighter or darker than other times. And sometimes that's because of what I'm like directly experiencing in the moment. Like, you know, the logical way you would think, like you're going through a harder time, you make darker work. But also I've had experiences where I'm doing better. And so I'm like ready to really dive into something that's been
you're ready to actually process it.
Yeah. And I'm like ready to kind of go there. But one thing I've been talking about with my other friend, Amanda Sandlin, who will be on the show, who we met for a brief second when we came in, when she visited, her work also has gone through times where it's been darker and she's been on a mental health like journey as well. And for me, I also started medication last year and it's helped a lot. So for me, like as my state has changed and I've become a little less, not less emotional, more emotionally regulated.
Yes.
I've had to like adjust, you know, where I get my inspiration from, because a lot of the time it would be like I'm processing something and I like need that catharsis. And these stories are so important to me and so integral to my work, but at work, I'm kind of like grappling with the question, what happens when your state changes, but your message like wants to be the same?
What would what would work look like? I guess I'm curious for you is like, what would work for you look like without darkness? Because what I think is interesting about your work and what I think your work is fundamentally about is about a darkness in what appears to be a light time, like barbed wire in the dollhouse. You know, that is like to me, I'm like, oh, this appears beautiful. And then you see the details and the details are a little bit dark. They're giving you a little bit of sinister.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering, like, I think for me, the themes of dark versus light are always together in my work as well. Like, I have my unicorns and their perfect little world, and then there's a skull at the bottom. Because mm-hmm. to me, the two, there is no light without darkness. We wouldn't even have a name for it. We wouldn't even know what it was called. So right. like, if your world and if your life only had beautiful moments, you wouldn't even know that it was beautiful because you had never seen darkness. So like, for you, what would your work look like without those notes of darkness? And what for you does that work still feel like it's worth making, I think is the question.
Yeah, I have made work like that before. Actually, I think before I took this turn, like some of the work in the Brea show, like there were chains in it, but it wasn't as dark, especially mm-hmm. the work for that show was supposed to be all about joy. But my work has changed so much since then that I'm sure it would be different now. I'm not sure. I think that the contrast in the pieces is what holds my interest. So that's kind of where it's like hard to depict like something without it.
Yeah.
But I'm not opposed to it. And I think I could. And sometimes there are little scenes that come up that I'm like, no, it's just cute and happy.
Yeah.
But I haven't fully ran with that yet.
I think about artists like Kara Walker, and we covered her recently on Pod Vanguard. We did a whole episode on her, and she's a really interesting artist because if you don't know who Kara Walker is, she's super famous. Look her up. Listen to the Pod Vanguard episode. But her work is mostly about the horrors of slavery, like rape, you know, violence, maiming, like, and she shows people as silhouettes, but she shows very violent things being done to Black people specifically by white people, and it is horrific. And for me, mentally, I'm like, I could not make work like that every day mm-hmm. without getting stuck into the darkness of it. And I think for you, like, I don't think there's a problem with processing darkness. I think it makes your work really beautiful. And you know, but if you made one dollhouse that was just like
nice
everything. Yeah. If you made one dollhouse that was nice, but this is something actually I just made a piece kind of about this yesterday, is like, what is difficult, and I've seen you bring this up before, is you have this sort of like ghost character in yours, and I call them like summer ghosts, which is like when you remember a time that was good, but then there's a sadness to it because it wasn't what you either, like, there are memories in my childhood that I remember that I'm like, this is the most beautiful time, but I was with someone who I no longer speak with, I no longer have a relationship with. And that sort of taints the memory with the sadness, or like, I had this amazing opportunity because my parents weren't around, or, you know, whatever. And so like, there, I think the sadness is always going to be with the beauty and with the light. And I think sort of that character that you have of the ghost is a great representation of that. Like, if you made these like beautiful, beautiful, fantastical scenes, and then you just had like little ghosts, that would be cool, you know?
I would be open to that.
Yeah,
I could see that.
I think those are themes that you're already exploring, is how memories are sort of tainted by these dark moments, but how you still try to find the joy and the beauty in them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna think about that. I'm gonna let that marinate. Because I was actually gonna go in a different direction, which is, okay, I'm not always conceptualizing my work from a place of catharsis, which is positive for my life. But I can still choose like, it doesn't have to come from that place. I can still choose the stories that are important to me. And I actually heard something that I wanted to share on this subject. I know this is controversial, but it's from J.K. Rowling, because I listened to, what is it called? There's like some podcast that explores all her like horrible comments and whatever.
Oh, really? I didn't know.
It's really
about
interesting.
That.
I got to find the name of it. But anyway, the first episode, they go more into like, you know, what led her to write the Harry Potter books in the first place. And
she's such an interesting figure to me because yeah. I loved her in my childhood. I still love the original 7 books she created, but I will not give her any more money. So
no,
I'm like,
no.
That's where it's I love this thing you did, but you also suck and you kind of ruined some shit for me. Also, those books have some weird racist shit in them. Anyway,
oh, totally. But. Totally. Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of hard to be like, she did say one cool thing I'm not condoning all of her other bullcrap.
Absolutely.
But, she said that when she was like first conceiving of the idea of Harry Potter, she was like in a very abusive relationship and difficult time in her life. Mm-hmm. And so that darkness is kind of woven into the character inherently, which like we, you know, if you've seen the movies or read the books, like it's kind of a dark story at a lot of pieces.
It and goes very quickly from a children's story where the stakes are pretty low mm-hmm. to a children's story that involves murder, you know, yeah. like it really ramps up. And I think what is so interesting about those books and so different from any other series I've ever read is that you as the reader are growing with the character of Harry. So every year is another year. Mm-hmm. He doesn't stay the same. His friends don't stay the same. They experience real trauma and change very much based on the real trauma they experience. And like you as a reader are able to grapple with darker themes because now you're 16 or 17 or 18 or yeah. how, you know? So it's like, it was this very unique experience for the time that our generation grew up with.
Yeah, totally.
That a lot of other books don't do. Like a lot of other books, the series will come out and it's still just a lighthearted kids show or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah. So like they're dark books.
They get fucking dark. Yeah.
And but basically what she said was that, you know, once she like got out of that dark time in her life and got out of that abusive relationship and like had settled in a different way, she's like still writing these books. She's no longer in that place, but like the seed of Harry, like there was this dark element to the story. And she talks about like how, even though she wasn't in that place anymore, it was very important for her to carry that all the way through. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of how I'm thinking about my changing state. And also my work is like, I don't have to be in the state to make work about it. I can decide that something is important and let it be a theme. It's just an adjustment in my own process. And yeah,
I think this thing is going to happen as you grow. And I mean, I personally have allowed myself to go through many changes in style. Mm-hmm. And I think that X, Y, or Z is like a departure. Like, I think it's like a huge change. And the people who have followed me for a long time in my audience are like, no, we still like it. We still like this stuff you're making. We still think it's cool. It's different than what you made 3 years ago or 4 years ago or 5 years ago. And I think this comes back to our conversation of being allowed to grow as artists.
Yeah.
And being allowed to express something authentic. And I think you'll know as an artist when what you've been doing doesn't feel like it fits anymore. It feels like a shirt you've grown out of, and you're just gonna be like, you know what, I just want to do something else. And I think you'll let it go when it's ready. But I think right now the themes that you've started exploring in your work are still worth exploring.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that when you decide to shift, or if you decide to shift in a significant way away from the type of work you've been making, you absolutely need to create a book about it. I'm
yes,
a huge believer
and this
in books.
Is Andrea's closing statement that I hear every time.
Make
tell
a book.
Us, Andrea. Tell us about
make
making
a book.
Art books.
Make an art book. This is why. This is what I'm going to say about it. I've made 2 big art books and 2 zines. I'm probably going to make I just proposed another art book of terrariums for a residency. We'll see if I get the residency because money is awesome. I'll still do one anyway. But this is the thing about art books. Art books, for me, are a way to when you finish a body of work, when you finish like a big achievement. For me, it was the most recent one, I did a solo show. So I made, I don't know, 62 pieces of original artwork with some sketches. I had it all in a show. It was all about one thing. It's called Stratosphere. It's using clouds specifically as a metaphor, clouds and flowers mostly, as sort of this metaphor for life and death, changing of the seasons, the seasons of life, the love that we share, the love that's lost, people die. Weirdly, I did this portrait series called Burial Portraits. There were 13. There were 12 portraits, one skull. One of my friends who I painted died. I sent the painting to his sister. She wrote me a lovely letter. The lovely letter is now tucked into my copy of the book. It's one of the most powerful series I've ever created. And what I did is I have all these poems that I wrote about the pieces that were kind of like, to me, they work together with the pieces. They're about love. They're about loss. They're about, for me, this really important relationship I was in that died. And with that death of the relationship came all these other deaths of myself, of who I was with that person, the future I imagined with that person, the kind of life I thought I would have with that person. All those things kind of died. And I had to re-examine myself and re-examine what it meant to be myself. And so that whole book is a culmination of the writings, the ideas, the paintings, the work that was created, the sketches I made that never even became paintings, all that is in there as a book. And I got to close the book and let go of all of that work. That work mm-hmm. still exists. I love that work. The work I make now is entirely different. But I needed to do that as a catharsis to let go of that moment and that version of myself. Because a lot of my work is about life and death. It's about those cycles and those changes. I allow myself to die all the time as an artist. And I need that death so that something new can grow up. And I'm a completely different version of myself than I was 3 or 4 years ago because I let those pieces die. I'm not trying to hold on to every past version of me. And there's like, if I was trying to still make the work I made when I was an undergrad, why?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a different person. I want to let myself grow and change. And so like being able to collect that work is a way to honor it. And it's a way to sort of pay homage to that past version of yourself, but it's also a way to let yourself grow out of it.
Yeah.
And you get to make some money. Big fan of money always. But it really is a way to like share the full culmination of that experience as it was meant to be experienced as a complete show. So that's what I believe about artist books. It's important to me.
Okay, I've never heard you share that perspective. I've heard you share the money perspective.
Oh yeah, the money. Money is also important. It's important.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. The money part. Yeah. So artist books, they take time to create, but it's a great way to earn income from a body of work you've created that maybe you haven't been able to sell, or maybe, you know, I still have a lot of those paintings available. Hit me up if you want them. But it's a great way to also for me to be able to share with my audience, like the whole thing, because, you know, a lot of people don't live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. They didn't go to the show. They didn't get to see all the work together. So it's a great way to kind of have that same experience as the show, but then it's an accessible way for them to own the work, if that makes sense, and be able to like reflect back on it. Cause I understand that, you know, obviously when I was a kid and I grew up, I couldn't afford to buy original artwork, and all my favorite artists, I would get books about them because that's how I could access the work. So it's a great way to make an affordable way for people to access your work and also to make money as an artist.
To make money. Yeah.
We love money.
Cool. I'm more sold now than I've ever been.
I want to sell everyone on creating an art book because I love books. I actually just, there's an artist residency at the Los Angeles Public Library, and I wrote a whole thing about how much I love books and how much I want to create an artist book for them. And also I want money. Please give me money. Hey, library, if you're listening to this episode.
We accept donations, sponsorships. We both have a Patreon.
We would love to do it. Oh yeah, I do have a Patreon. That's pretty tight too.
Yeah.
We can, I mean, we talked about that when our artist making money episode, didn't we?
I think we did. Why did you have a new thought on it?
No, just it's the best thing ever. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of Patreon in general. I think it's a great way to connect to your audience. I hope my patrons get something great out of it. It seems like they're really big fans. Mine includes at my highest tier, I think it's $30 a month. Every month I make a painting and someone from that tier gets the original painting that I make. And then everyone else gets all the stickers, but I usually send them some type of original artwork at least once. So if you're in that tier, you'll get an original piece from me eventually, either a sketch, a painting, sometimes both.
Yeah, you have that set up really well. Actually, kind of before when I was talking about like having some income that gives you a little bit of space, like if needed, Patreon is probably more that for you, which is cool.
My Patreon kind of fluctuates. I haven't been able to get it any higher. I started it 2 years ago and it's been pretty much the same as when I started it. I would love for that number to be higher because it is great, but it is a thing where like just knowing every month that I'm going to have $800 that I don't have to hustle for, that, you know, I make two paintings, I turn those paintings into stickers, the end. Like I know I'm going to have X amount of money for doing X amount of work. Is like so much stress off my plate is just knowing that that money will be there. And so if you're part of my Patreon and you're listening to this, I love you so much more than anyone else that isn't part of my Patreon. No, I'm joking. I definitely, my boyfriend's not part of my Patreon, but I love him a lot as well. But thank you. I love you. You're the best. Thank you.
I love when I make
Devin laugh so much she loses her train of thought.
Oh, it's just like the show that is Andrea. That's why we love you.
I won't shut up. This is the thing. People are like, oh, Andrea, will you do my podcast? It's like, oh my God, yes. I love talking. I won't shut up. It's hard to get me to stop. If you have a podcast, I'll be on your podcast.
I know. That's why you're the best, though. Like, I think, I don't know, just going back to talking about people having such an investment in you and then like also, you know, you coming from the Midwest and like wanting to make friends and like all this is such a strength for you. And I always tell people, I'm like, if you can be like Andrea, you should do that. If you can make friends, if you can go to openings and just talk to people, you should. I can't. I have to go with Andrea under her wing. But if you can, you should.
Get yourself in an emotional support, Andrea, to do all the talking. Here's the thing.
Literally.
Here's a secret about me as a person. I used to be super shy because, so I definitely have social anxiety. Ugh, people all around me. Ah, so scary. What I did to overcome that is I did stand-up comedy for 5 years. What is great about stand-up comedy is you learn how to talk about yourself in a way that helps people connect with you. It was a great exercise. It also taught me that I'm afraid of no one. Like, no one has anything that they can say to me that can really hurt me, honestly. Someone else's words, someone else's opinions. At the end of the day, this is advice my mother gave me when I was younger because I had a hard time talking to people. People just want to be heard. So most people don't care about what you have to say. If you're in a situation and you're like, I'm with someone and I don't know them, or I'm like yesterday, I went to a party. I only knew like three people at the party. So what I did instead is I just started asking people about themselves. Oh, how did you meet host? What did you do this weekend? You just ask people questions and then they'll start talking and then you'll find something maybe that you have in common, or you'll find something interesting about them. They'll talk for a while. Maybe that, you know, allows you an opening, but that's just how you conversation. And then when you're like, oh my God, I've been talking to this person for way too long, you say, I have to go to the bathroom. I'm sorry.
Literally. I do that too.
And then like, you go, oh, to the bathroom, someone's here. Check Instagram. Yeah. Or you see a friend like, oh my God, I have to say hello to so-and-so. Yeah, yeah. And then you walk away and that's it. And it's fine. Yeah. And they're not offended. You don't have to feel bad. I used to do this thing where I would go to parties and I would find one person and I would talk to them all night because I felt safe with that person and I would annoy the shit out of them. And I knew that was happening, but I didn't know what else to do. So then now you just go to the bathroom and then at the bathroom, you're like, oh, long line, eh? Or you just like make a joke. It makes people feel comfortable. And then you can start asking them questions about themselves. So just keep doing that forever. At art openings, my go-to is, oh, are you in this show? What's your piece? Tell me about it. Or it's like, oh, that's your boyfriend. Wow, real piece of work. And then, you know, whatever you do to bond, don't insult their boyfriend, but you know,
just yeah, try to I like conversation. That though, as a tip. I like that as a tip for art openings, actually, because that's something I've never talked about on the show because it's something I straight up don't do is like talk to people I don't know. I don't do that. But if you want to meet people and you're in a new city, and if you want to like get in with people you don't know or whatever, like that is what you have to do. So I think that that's actually really good advice. Like, how do you actually go to an opening by yourself if you are brave enough to do so and like actually connect with the people there?
Okay. So this is where fashion has come in clutch for me. Fashion. If you go to art openings, especially in LA, people wear weird shit. And part of that is we're doing it on purpose so that we look the part of the artist. I went to an art opening in San Francisco. It was my first time at this gallery. I wore a pastel pink dress with poofy sleeves. I wore knee-high stockings. I wore all pink, like a pink jacket. Everyone else at the gallery was wearing black jeans and a black t-shirt. There are photos of that gallery opening where it's like a sea of black and then me. Guess who matched their painting? Guess who? Well, also this other thing happened where one of my friends came and brought flowers. So I didn't know anyone else at the opening except the curator. I was holding flowers. There were a couple artists who came that I knew, but they didn't get there till later. So I'm just walking around carrying flowers. Well, then people are like, oh, are you one of the artists? Which piece is yours? Now we're having a conversation. I made some great friends at that show, but wearing an outfit that looks similar to your work or people will be able to remember and connect your work to you as a person is also a great sort of how-to go to art openings because it's a way to stand out. And it's what you want to do is to be memorable enough that people will associate your face with the art that you do. So that is why I on purpose wear pink. I wear bright colors. I wear fun things. They always match my paintings. When I went to the unicorn opening, I wore a lavender Selkie dress with a unicorn horn. Everyone asked me about my outfit. There were other people there in fun, cute outfits, but it was a way for people to kind of connect the artist to the piece. And I highly recommend doing that. If your comfort zone is black, try a fun accessory, try chunky jewelry, try cool shoes, just a way for people to connect with you.
Yeah, this is such, I think just the statement of like, you want people to associate your face with the work you make. Mm-hmm. I think that's really good to keep in mind. And it's just the reality.
If you're a boy, here's the thing too. Okay. So I know fashion is generally for the gals and guys, you're less like into that.
It's mostly girls who listen to the show anyway.
Or some dudes. But one of my friends, Anthony, actually got one of his own paintings printed on a t-shirt that wears the t-shirt.
That's so funny.
It does the same job, but it's like, it's a way for people like, oh my God, that's the same. And then he's the only one who owns that t-shirt. He never made other t-shirts. He was going to and he didn't, so he only has one t-shirt in existence. He's the only one that owns it, and he wore it to an art opening we were at, and I saw people connect the dots of like, you're the same art. And then he would stand next to his piece. So there's other ways you can do it that aren't so like, I have to be this giant fashionista or something. But
I'm also realizing in all of this, and it's something I'm working on, but I'm imagining there's some listeners who can relate to this. Literally everything you're saying is like the opposite of what I try to do, like what my natural state is. Like my natural state is like, I don't want to be seen. I want to meet new people for the sake of meeting them, but I actually don't want the experience of talking to them and meeting them because I don't really like it. And like, I just want to go and be a fly on the wall, like, truthfully. But that's like in conflict with another desire I have, which is to make art friends and be in more shows and like have people know what my work is and like all this stuff. And there has to be some sort of bridge there. If you want to play in this realm or operate in this way, there's other options where you can just do online stuff and that's cool too. But I'm just realizing like you're so good at everything you're saying. And I think that's why you've made all the connections you have and all the friends that you have. And so if there's any way that like any of us can even take this advice with like a grain of salt, I think it's very helpful.
I think understanding that it is intentional and like, I'm not naturally good at this. I was not always this way. I remember art openings where I would go and I would stand by my painting and my painting was in the weird part of the building that like barely had any light in it. And I would go home and cry to my boyfriend and be like, no one talked to me. I don't know anyone. I felt so weird. And like the only person stopping you from making those connections is your own insecurity about being worth talking to. It's not,
yeah,
no one's thinking badly about you. No one hates you. No one's thinking mm-hmm. about you, if I'm being honest. And so if you just, instead of like always having to be on the defense, if you go on the offense and say like, I'm going to make an effort, you can even make a dumb goal for yourself. I'm going to talk to 3 people I've never met before. Oh, hey, I like your shirt. It can just be that. You don't have to go any further than that. Or, oh my God, isn't that piece amazing? Like if you see someone seeing a piece and you just turn to them and go, can you believe they made this? You know, just anything that is an opening into a conversation, and it's hard to do and you're going to hit or miss. It's kind of like, I feel like almost like the pickup artist of art openings.
You totally are.
So like wear a cool hat.
Yeah.
And then you just, you know, it really is like, you're kind of using that psychology of like, you're just trying to make a connection with a stranger. It could just be for a second, but sometimes it'll happen where like, you're like, oh my God, yes, that's exactly what I was saying. And they're like, this is my piece. And you're like, oh my God, you're so cool. Can I follow you on Instagram? And then you'll follow them and then they'll follow you and then you'll see each other. And then you'll at least be like, I met this person in real life. I know them. There are people who I've met at one art opening and now we're friends. And I think they're hilarious and we chat and like, I love them. They're great because I actually made an effort to say hello one time.
Yeah.
It's worth it.
Totally. I'm actually remembering, I went to Spring Break Art Fair this year, which was super cool. And the nature of that is that the artists like have to kind of man their booth unless they're being shown by a curator, but a lot of them, the artists are there, like they have to talk about their own work. Like their job is kind of to talk to you, which is interesting. Absolutely. And I think what makes it a little different. And just from attending that and talking to them, and that's like an easy, like it's natural to walk in and be like, oh cool, is this your work, you know?
Yeah.
And like just exchanging Instagram handles with these people, like all of a sudden you're like, I know more people, like this person knows my work, I know their work. It really snowballs that easily. I think that's good advice.
There's also this idea, and this happened in stand-up when I did it too, where people are always trying to like clout chase. So they're like, have you heard of so-and-so? They have a solo show and they do this and they're that. Those are not the people that you need to be making friends with. You need to be making friends with the other people who are in your class. Meaning we all did a show at La Luz de Jesus together. We all did this, you know, group show. We're in the group show together because that's your class, right? That's like almost, I think of it like sophomore, freshman, upperclassmen, whatever. We're the freshmen. We're doing, you know, we're entering. I would say we're sophomores now, right?
Yeah, I'm like freshman and a half.
Freshman and a half.
I'm on summer break. Yeah.
We're on summer break. We're still doing our, you know, group art shows. We're still applying to opportunities. We're still trying to get more recognition, but we've done it enough that we're not complete noobs at it. But those are the people that are going to have, you know, that are going to want to be your friends, first of all, because the people who are like upperclassmen, they'll, you know, you can find a few people like that are going to want to mentor you. I have a few people like that have like recommended for me for shows, but for the most part, the people who are uplifting me are especially other women in our year, in our class, who are in the same level as us. And we're all uplifting each other. I when I get a invitation to a group show, you know what I do? I say like, oh my God, I have this friend. I think their work would be perfect for this show. Have you considered them? Mm-hmm. I'll send it to a curator, especially if it's a show that's being put on by another artist. I feel very comfortable sending, you know, something to that. I have a friend who I recommended her for a group show we were going to do. I had to drop out because of mental health crisis. She wound up selling that painting to an institution that she did for that. You know what I mean? It's just like, yeah, that's what I want. I want my friends to succeed. I want to uplift them. I want to make friends. And it sounds selfish when you say it like a sociopath, but if you help the people around you succeed, they're going to want to see you succeed too.
Yeah.
That's sociopathic, but it's also true. But that's also just the nature of like making genuine connections and friendship with people.
Yeah. 100% connect with your peers. I think that's really good advice and something that I try to tell to like anybody who I mentor or work with or students. I'm like, dude, find your peers,
figure out who's
at in your stage of the game and grow with them. Yeah.
Well, and you guys are the people, like I have several different group chats that I'm like, where did you get those prints? How did you make that? What did you apply to? You know, like the number of times that there's been an opportunity and then I just never heard about it until it's over with, you know, it's like, fuck, I should have applied to that. Now you have this group chat and like, I try to, if I remember, you know, post it on my Instagram stories, post opportunities, DM them. If I see an opportunity and I'm like, this would be such a good fit for my friend X, Y, or Z. I am a white woman. Do you know how many open calls I see for Latin American artists? A billion. We live in SoCal. You know who I send them to? All my Latin American artist friends.
Yeah.
It's not a good fit for me. I'm not going to apply to that. But
yeah,
my friends can maybe benefit, you know, like, do that.
Yeah, totally. All right. We have had a long show. I think I want to break this into two episodes. I was like, whatever, let's just keep going with it. This is going to be like one of those podcasts that has 2.5 hour episodes and that just like is what it is. But I'm here for it because I think we covered a lot of ground that I wasn't expecting to cover, but I think was much more interesting than a lot of the things we were going to talk about. Yes. But I do want to end, I want to full circle it anyway, just by maybe each of us kind of, like parting words or advice for working artists who have their own mental health struggles.
It is not a personal failing to need help from other people. I know in your brain, you're like, I'm a burden. I don't want to burden anyone with my problems. It's not a personal failing to admit that you need help. It's not a personal failing to take a pill. If, you know, I think I had this huge fear about any sort of psychiatric medication is that it would alter a piece of who I am.
Mm-hmm.
It has not. All it did is it turn the volume down on crippling anxiety so that I can go to sleep at night. That's it. I take a very small amount. I'm on like the lowest dose you can take basically and have it still be effective. And I worked my way up to that. My doctor told me to take this higher dose right away. I don't listen to doctors. I like weaned myself into it so that my body could adjust. It's been extremely beneficial. It is the only reason I can function today. I was to a point where I was like, I'm not saying I want to harm myself, but I'm saying that I cannot live like this. Something has to change. Yeah. And if you are to that point, medicine is great. I understand healthcare is expensive. I understand it's not accessible to everyone, but it is so worth it to just get the pill. You only have to see your psychiatrist every month or two. You know, that bill is worth it to feel mentally like you can function and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's been such a journey for me. I talked about this in the last solo episode, but there's so much stigma around it, which I think is why, like, it's such a personal decision. So I'm not like giving advice, but I do just think it's good to just talk about our experiences because it takes away from the stigma, you know?
Absolutely.
And also like, this might sound trite, but like, it's not your fault. Like,
absolutely not.
Yeah. I think I spend a lot of time.
See Robin Williams talking in Good Will Hunting. It's not your fault.
Yeah.
It's not your fault.
Yeah. I spend a lot of time like feeling like I should be differently. Like I shouldn't be tired. I shouldn't be depressed. Why am I this way? And like all of that just takes so much energy, you know?
It's not worth it.
And it's not worth it. Yeah. It just, it is what it is, and it's not your fault. And I think the more I've gotten into this, and the more, just the longer I've lived with it, I think the more I realize it's truly not my fault. Like a lot of it is genetic. And yeah. And so there's nothing to like feel ashamed about. There's no shame in needing help. There's no shame in taking rest. And I think that it is possible to find a way to do things like within a rhythm that works with your system. It just might take a little bit of time. Yeah.
Well, and I think there is also this thing that happens where, again, social media is not real life.
Mm-hmm.
You think that people, well, only I'm going through this. Why don't other people have this? Why do I need this and someone else doesn't?
Mm-hmm.
You have no idea what people are going through and not telling you about. I have no boundaries. I share a lot on social media. I think it's better for me. I feel better being an authentic version of me and oversharing.
Yeah.
It's not for everyone. But I think there are a lot of people that look like they're doing well on the outside, and that image is more important to them than an authentic experience. Especially, you know, sometimes like celebrities and stuff are going to do that. And part of that is because they don't want everyone to know the nitty gritty intimate details of what they're struggling with or who they are. But you comparing yourself to people you don't really know is not helpful. And accepting yourself for where you're at and finding solutions that actually work for you is helpful. So don't worry about what other people, why do I need a pill? Why do I need therapy? Why do I need this? I shouldn't have to, but you do. So just, it's fine.
Yeah. And you're going to be you for the rest of your life. Like that's something I actually heard a friend say.
Exhausting.
Yeah. Like years ago, she said it was something I think her psychiatrist said to her. It's like, you're going to be you for the rest of your life. So if there's anything that can help you, like, whatever that is,
absolutely,
like it's your job to lean into it, you know.
Knowing yourself is so powerful, and knowing your own limitations and allowing yourself to rest when you're tired, to say, hey, this is really too much for me, I really actually can't do this right now. Saying no is really important. All those things of just like knowing yourself. If you look in your heart and you're like, am I actually gonna do this, or is it gonna stress me the fuck out? And then I'm going to be anxious, and then I'm not actually going to do it. You just say no right away, whether that's a party, whether that's a art show, whether that is, you know, whatever. Say no.
Actually, on that note, just because we are jumping all over the place and then we will conclude, but I do think that this saying no thing is an important part of the conversation just for all artists. And especially if you're navigating mental health stuff.
Yeah.
I always tell people, like, if it is not bringing you value, like meaning you're going to make money, you are going to meet people or be exposed to people that like you think will actually help your career, or your work is going to get exposed to like a new set of collectors, curators, and even other artists, I would say those are the two main things. If neither of those things are going to happen, it's probably not for you. If you literally have nothing going on and all the time in the world and you're just like bored, okay, that's fine. But if you are actually trying to move forward and you don't have unlimited time and resources, you don't have to say yes to everything, and not all shows are going to benefit you. So like if you're at a certain stage and it's like somebody wants to hang one of your paintings like in their cafe, or whatever, like
don't hang your art in cafes. First of all, it devalues the work. If you want to go the cafe route and you want to just whatever, fine. But
and
you're
I think
not
it's
really
fine when you're starting.
Art. When yeah. you're starting, absolutely. Yeah. But if you've already been showing in major galleries, don't do that because it devalues yeah. the work and it makes people take you less seriously as an artist. I don't make the rules. That's just what it is. Also, a lot of times cafes will give you your work back damaged. They don't yeah. take, it's not a gallery. You know, they're not taking care of it like it's a gallery. So they're going, it's not good. Just sell it online. Don't take your art to a cafe, please.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. Okay. I think that's what I wanted to say about that.
We'll be doing 6 more podcasts yeah, yeah. where I just ramble on forever.
Brace yourself for 12 more hours.
We don't sleep. We pull an all-nighter to do this yeah. podcast. I'm Joe Rogan now.
I know. Seriously. I was thinking, I was like, what podcast is 2.5 hours? Do I really want to be like Joe Rogan? But in all seriousness, I appreciate you so much.
I love you so much.
I'm so glad that we met and became friends.
Me too.
Yeah, it's amazing. So I'm so happy to have you on the show and have more people get to know you the way that I do. So thanks for coming on and
thanks
making this killer long episode.
Thanks for doing my dishes when I was crying all the time.
Anytime.
Big thanks to Andrea for coming on the show and being so open, not to mention hilarious. I love listening to her, and I think you guys do too. Please go check out and support her work. She's at Andrea Gazzetta on Instagram. Her website is andreagazzetta.com, and she's also part of another podcast that is awesome called Podmontgarde. I highly recommend that. It's like a radical art history podcast. If you like this one, you're going to love that. And I believe that is all I have in store for you today. So thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week, next Thursday, with another conversation that I'm excited to share with you. In the meantime, I'm sending you lots of love and tons of magic.